This episode of the Tech Central podcast is brought to you by Pinnacle, Africa's top ICT distribution business, delivering the exceptional every time. I'm Duncan MacLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm on an internet call now to Stellenbosch to talk to Skalk Noltier, founder and CEO of Entersect, a Stellenbosch-based information security company whose products you probably use every day without even realizing it. Skalk, who started his career in telecommunications working for both Telkom and for Vodacom, saw a gap in the market to address problems with online banking security. He raised $250,000 from an angel investor, and Entersect was born. The company has since grown enormously and attracted many millions of dollars more in investment from the likes of Nedbank, Rand Merchant Investments, and Endeavor. Skalk, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for talking to Tech Central today.
Thank you very much, Duncan. Happy to be here.
So, Skalk, you started your career at Telkom, in fact, and I think you had a bursary from them, if I remember correctly. You then moved to Vodacom. Were you always attracted to the telecom sector?
I think from the earlier days, specifically at that, it was the year 2000, mobile was still a bit of a novelty, but it was pretty evident then that it was going to be quite a bit of a game changer in terms of how people communicate, how the internet was not even born yet in terms of mobile side. And I think the fact that this was new, this was shiny, and there was a lot of opportunity around it is what attracted me on the mobile side. Obviously, on the fixed line side, it was just more of the same. This is telecommunications, which is very important, of course. But I think the fact that this is groundbreaking at that stage, new, etc., was what attracted me.
All right. Did you study engineering? What was your background?
Yeah, I studied engineering, Stellenbosch University. Electrical, electronic, yes. So always interested in the technology side of things. But a bit more ended up, as I said, as you mentioned, with Telkom, with a bursary, and they threw me into project management right away, which took me out of the deep tech side. In hindsight, I think I'm quite thankful for that. I don't think I would be a very good techie itself, but I think the background in terms of technology is very much there, and the interest itself, yes, it led to where we are today.
Great. So how did the idea for Entersect come about? What was the problem you were trying to solve? What did you identify you wanted to try and fix in that space?
So we are five founders, all engineers, all Stellenbosch University engineers. And the engineering side itself, obviously, Christian Brunt. I think he attended an ITU conference. This was in the year 2008. And also saw then, and I think immediately prior to that, a family member of his fell victim to phishing. So in the year 2008, if we recall, in South Africa specifically, the banks forced you to do SMS or one-time passwords, even per transaction, and they also forced you to download malware protection. So as mentioned, a member of his family fell victim to phishing at that stage, and came back to Stellenbosch University having seen some talk around this at IT Web conference, brainstormed with the rest of the team and said, listen guys, I mean, how is it possible with all this technology being forced upon you, this seeming solutions that the banks are telling you must use this and must use this, that you can still fall victim to fraud? I mean, obviously that means something isn't working, and anything that doesn't work means there's opportunity. And at that stage, OTPs were at the forefront of technology. We always found it interesting that in the year 2012 in the US there was a firm that won an innovation award for SMS OTP, and that even today we're still coming across banks in the US that are only thinking of implementing one-time password now. But whereas we in this part of the world have realized quite a while ago that it actually does not solve the problem. But yeah, we realized there's an opportunity. Existing tech doesn't work, which means we thought about how can we fix this? And all being engineers, thought about how would you actually address this from a pure engineering and without being placed in a box with a banking background, how would you solve this? We came upon the mobile. Mobile is a very personal device, and we thought, if there was a way that I could actually reach out to your device, specifically ask you a question just before we go through and just check, is this really what you want to do? That would be pretty powerful. And that's what we came up in 2008. We filed patents and, as you've mentioned, found some funding a year later. it was just after the Great Recession of 2008. So to find funding, especially, you know, having no background in banking or security in any of these things, wasn't that easy. But that's how we came about.
Well, let's talk about that funding, because you had an initial angel investor, a gentleman by the name of Ramzi Mansour. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. He now serves as the chairman of Intersect's board of directors. Is he, and how did that initial contact come about?
So Ramzi Mansour is a gentleman that I met in my telecom days in Nigeria. He's a Lebanese-Australian gentleman, actually. And what he's about is specifically finding, you know, young companies and investing in them. I think he's very, very good at actually, you know, specifically finding people with talent. So he invests as an angel in a number of businesses, a lot of them being very successful. We had met on a personal, you know, basis, became friends, never did business together, but he always said, listen, you know, if you ever come across something that's interesting, give me a call. And that's what happened. So, you know, I gave him a call in 2009. I said, listen, Ramzi, I think we're onto something here. Prepared a business plan and, you know, pitched to him along with other founders at a hotel in Centurion. Mm-hmm. And, he said, I'm in. And, you know, gave us the cash before we even had a company ready. So that was quite interesting, trying to get dollars into the country at that stage, or into a company that didn't exist. But we learned a lot of lessons very quickly and ensured that all the structures are ready, etc. And the rest is history so far.
Okay. And you've concluded a number of further funding rounds prior to that initial angel investment funding. I think one with Nedbank or a division of Nedbank, and more recently with RMI and Endeavor. Tell us about those.
Yes. So with Nedbank, it's the private equity side of that. So the interesting part about in South Africa, specifically doing business-to-business software and in the banking industry, is of course the, you know, for a bank to take a decision on a new technology is not easy, and it's understandable. I think a lot of people get frustrated with banks about there's this new tech out, or is this very new cool idea, why don't you guys take it? But it is something for them to roll out something to millions of people, you know, create the training material behind that, train their call centers, and is not easy. It's very large scale, and specifically, if you need to take a chance on something that might not be around, you know, in a couple of months' time, it isn't the way to go. So we found that specifically, you know, a lot of the banks said the first meeting was an amazing idea, you know, next meeting will be at your office. And that obviously is to see if there's some substance behind us. So we realized pretty early on that we need to, in terms of image, find a, you know, an office that actually also plays the bit in terms of PR.
Yeah.
That looks the deal, you know, has a boardroom that actually is a bit more corporate than you'll typically find in a high-tech, fintech environment, because yet again, you know, we understand who our customers are and we want to make them feel comfortable.
Yes.
So these guys, so that's why we actually, obviously, you had to first build the software, make it stable, make it scalable before you could actually roll out. And it forced us at that stage to do a lot of fundraising initially. So I think Nedbank Private Equity were the first guys to get on board. And after that, I think it's last year, well, it is last year, about June, about a year ago, we did a further round with RMI and Endeavor Catalyst, which was expansion capital. So at this stage where we are, we achieved about 80% market penetration in South Africa. That's if you count the actual number of banks, not per se or necessarily the number of customers out there. And we wanted to ensure that in this day and age where technology is, the minute you put something in an app store, anybody in the globe can see it. And even though we have global patents, we could see that other firms were copying our ideas. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to ensure that we could quickly scale and specifically sign up key partnerships, because our strategy has always been, if you find these key partners and sign them up in terms of technology and distribution partners, even if somebody else were to copy your technology directly, even source code wise, you know, they can't really compete and get you out of the market, because A, you've got the history, B, of course you have some IP and patents, which is valuable, but lastly, you have you know, you've got this way to scale quickly, and scaling through salespeople is not the way to actually achieve J-curve. It is just too difficult, expensive. Any new market, you've got to compete with incumbents that have been there a long time. You have to create brand presence. You know, we've seen that going into a new market, completely new market, costs about $2-3 million to establish just a small footprint there. So it is expensive. And, you know, versus going through a partner that have these relationships and you just become a feature inside the technology, is a lot easier in our view. And we've seen this play out in reality.
Yeah, you mentioned you've registered global payments, patents rather, for your technologies. It must be a bit frustrating watching prospective competitors copying. I mean, it must be a bit disheartening.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't say it's really disheartening. It is, you know, probably a bit more irritating at this stage, to be honest.
Sure.
Specifically, if somebody goes into a market and you've done this years ago and have proven that's an incumbent vendor that, you know, just does slideware and the like. What we've decided is, we've also tested and seen in terms of, I think a lot of us see these IP lawsuits and think, that's the way it's done. Possibly so, but to pursue a lawsuit in terms of IP infringement in the US costs double-figure $1 million.
Ouch.
So it's very expensive to actually to make that decision and say, that you're going to go after that. So our strategy has been at this stage to try and stay ahead of the curve in terms of the fraudsters out there, but also stay ahead of the curve in terms of competition. And I think we've been very good at this in anticipating where the world is going. So yes, it is frustrating to see that stuff you come up with is being taken up. But on the other side, it also gives us validation because, the technology that we came up with is now becoming the global industry standard. Gartner states that push authentication, which is what it has now become, the accept, reject, or yes, no, that many of us, or most of us in South Africa use, is what we came up with in 2008. And currently it's 15% of global banks use this in terms of authentication. And by 2020, it'll be 80%. So it is nice and a good story to state to the banks that, listen, this is going to be the future. The previous thing that we said will be the future is now, actually did happen as we predicted. So you can trust us on this, and it does create a lot of credibility in terms of those type of discussions.
Sure. So, Scott, how big is the business now? I know you've got a lot of developers down in Stellenbosch, but how many clients do you have around the world, and how many end users does the technology reach now?
So we count typically a banking group as a single customer. So, a lot of these banking groups are in a number of countries where they actually have standalone entities as banks, and we deploy to all these. But we count the groups, and we've got more than 30 banking groups as customers. And we, at this stage, have quite a bit over 25 million active customers, growing at 1 million a month.
Wow.
So it is quite big, and a lot of people, I think in South Africa, it's over 17 million users that interact with our software, and most people, probably don't know that.
Well, that's pretty big. Who are some of your clients? I presume well-known local banks, but who are your major clients in South Africa and worldwide?
In South Africa, it's every single customer we sign an NDA with, so we can only mention the customers that are actually out in the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
So in South Africa, it's Nedbank, Capitec, Absa Investec, Old Mutual, and actually, quite a number of the other ones, and the new and younger and up-and-coming banks. In Africa, we've got Ecobank, Equity Bank, then quite a number of large customers in Germany, Switzerland, Pluscard, Bayamcard, part of the Barkasa group. And interesting, in the US, we've also partnered now with Equifax, where we, bring out a new identity program to try and, resolve some of the problems that the market and themselves have, been victim to in the past. So I think a lot of what the technology is moving to is specifically, in terms of the world out there, is moving away from just authenticating an action into actually a digital persona, where you actually say yes from the digital world, this is what I allow, and we create that link in between. But yeah, so quite a number of Coutts, the Bank of the Queen, is also a very nice customer of ours. So, yeah, a number of very, very well-known international customers.
All right. When you go into a client, how much you sign a deal with one of the big banks, say, how much integration work do you have to do with them? Is it quite a complex process integrating your technology with what are often legacy, very old, often in-house developed systems?
So it really depends on customer, exactly as you said. It depends on, you know, the legacy system. Some customers actually don't have any authentication, and then it's very difficult. You know, in certain areas of the world, specifically in the US, we've found that the banks outsource so much of their software that, you know, they can't even do this themselves, that you need to go to their partners, who obviously have vested, you know, many, very often have a vested interest to not do this. So we found this where it can be done in a couple of days to, you know, a couple of months, depending on the internal side of it. It's, from our side, it's very easy. It's all APIs. It's very mature, and you just consume it as that. So it can be very quickly, or it can, as I said, you know, be a number of months depending on the scale of the internal project required. So, you know, banks typically with older systems have to write a lot of middleware, and at this stage, you know, specifically a couple of years back, it was moving towards digital side where their identity and access management systems weren't really built to scale. So then it really did take some time to actually get an authentication system in.
All right. Scott, let's talk a bit about the technology now. You white label your technology for the banks, but how does the technology actually work, and what products do you offer to financial services institutions? Is there cryptography involved? Walk us through it. What is the tech behind this, and how long has it taken you to develop it and perfect it?
So it's to start with, how long is, you know, we've been at this 8 years with you know, roughly 40 people working on it full time. So obviously fewer initially and quite a bit more now. But in terms of what it basically is we realized quite a long time ago that a mobile is a very personal device. It's, you know, it's a PC you sit in front of, but it's your mobile device. And as I mentioned earlier, that if we try and figure out if we can actually create a specific link to reach out to a mobile, that would be quite interesting. So what we decided specifically while focusing on banks is that banks like standards. It obviously makes it easier to consume and understand, but specifically if you innovate and there's nothing out there to certify and put a stamp on that, yes, this is, you know, as per X standard, whatever that might be, if it's innovative stuff, it won't be a standard. So we decided to build as much as possible of this on standardized building blocks to, you know, to get past that hurdle. So it runs on a PKI, a public key infrastructure, and in essence what we do is we put our SDK or software development kit on a mobile device. It, you know, just compiled into your application that you build. And that mutual SSL, secure socket layer, what it does is establishes it from the device back to an HSM or hardware security module, which is inside some appliances that we put behind the bank's firewall. So a lot of technical terms later, what it means is that this device, your mobile device, which has been enrolled to you, can only speak to the correct server and vice versa. To us, the essence of all of this is trust. And we believe that trust is formed in three ways. The first one is identifying that this is the correct device. So that device ID, which is quite a big part of what we do, is very strong. Is key. The second part is integrity of that device or the application. So we do jailbreak detect, you know, routing, malware, all these things, and that changes continuously as, you know, attack vectors and technology comes stronger. So to ensure that, you know, not only this device is the one, we, you know, the correct device and the person behind it, but also the integrity of the application is correct and not being tampered with. And then lastly, you know, end-to-end encryption in terms of the channel that you're communicating with. And we believe if all those three are in place, and we do that, as I've said, through the basis of a PKI and a lot of other technology on top of that to determine other aspects, then we're okay that we can, you know, communicate with the correct person. On top of that is where we believe the really cool and interesting stuff can happen. So the first thing, we leverage that channel to obviously authenticate the mobile banking channel, or also to reach out to you to ask you, you know, if you've done the accept or reject or 109 in South Africa or wider in terms of transactions, because we give you transaction details and say, you know, is this really what you want to do? Every action is signed, so we can say, yes, this was done on your device by yourself. After that, you know, what we're doing now and deploying very soon in South Africa is getting, you know, mobile payments inside that same application. So our view in terms of the bank of the future is that the bank will become an anchor tenant if they play this right in terms of your digital identity. You're going through a lot of effort in any event to ensure that you're the person speaking to your bank, and vice versa. And we believe that should be leveraged and can be leveraged to protect yourself in the online world. So in terms of mobile payments, MasterPass and the like, put that inside the banking application. Messaging and secure trusted messaging, when we're seeing SMS is no longer a trusted channel, notifications and these things, everything should be in the banking channel. Document signing, in essence what we say is that anything and everything should be able to be done from a mobile device. And that's if you have that trust in place, then you can enable true mobility. And what we mean by that is you shouldn't care whether it's a mobile device. You shouldn't go into the branch for anything. You should be able to do anything from your mobile device.
Do you have any insight into what impact deploying this technology in the banks has had on fraud levels? Are there any case studies of what impact it's had?
We've had some case studies, and I think NetBank was the first one to actually make a press release immediately after we deployed many years ago. I think this was in Business Tech, if I recall, Business Insider, I forget. But their press release at that stage said that their phishing levels had fallen by well over 99%. We also see that Capitec made a press release, I think it was a couple of months back, where they said there's no fraud on their digital channels protected by us. So it is very, very impactful. And specifically, if you think about how these attacks take place, phishing, which is still the most prevalent, along with certain just slight variations of that, whether it's SIM swaps or malware targeting your banking credentials. Ultimately, all of these things can be defeated if you're sure that you're speaking with the right user and you ask them, is this action really something you want to do? I mean, a fraudster is not going to pay your existing beneficiaries, but they will try and do sensitive stuff like a once-off payments or move it to an account where they can actually fleece the money. So pushing that out to the customer with a very definitive, do you want to pay this person X? It's quite evident that you want to say no, and we've seen that.
Yeah, interesting. I wanted to ask you, just as an aside, the Home Affairs Department recently announced the launch of the biometric identification system, and I know some of the banks have started to look at that. Is that something that excites you? Is it something that you guys at Entersect could take advantage of?
Definitely. So, biometrics has been, I want to use the term hot, because that's how it's actually portrayed in the industry for a number of years now, because it is, what it does bring is a lot of ease of use. If we look at, the signing into your device with facial or fingerprint biometrics, it does make things easier. So, obviously biometrics also has some downfalls. If you think about, fingerprint, you only have 10 fingers. And if somebody has your fingerprint, you can only change your fingerprint as you can a password. So it has its place. We think there's also still other things that create that context. Let's use fingerprints yet again. If you go to any other border control and you put your fingerprints there on a device that's controlled by border control, then it actually is fine. So it's all about the context and the control of the device and the security that actually presents this credential. So in terms of Home Affairs, we're quite excited about that, and I think we've seen that a number of the banks are trying to do remote customer acquisition by testing and checking these databases. So technology not yet 100% sure. We've tested and played a number of these things that claims it can do a lot of things, and if you just try and break it a bit, of course we get past it. So I think, but it is improving leaps and bounds, and I think in terms of those kind of things with specifically Home Affairs, it will ensure that we can do a number of things remotely. So yet again, what we've seen, talking about government and Home Affairs, and back to my point earlier about banks actually playing quite a pivotal role in terms of authentication, we've seen in certain markets, Europe and Canada specifically being good examples, where the banks, whether it's SARS later on or Home Affairs, you can actually log on with your banking credential and use the authentication of the bank that we don't want to ensure that I'm not going to have a Home Affairs application on my phone most probably, and I'm not going to go into, as per FICA that forces us to do this, into my branch or Home Affairs every year to go and stand in a queue, or SARS similar. I interact with them once a year. So I think leveraging other technologies and building an ecosystem that actually leverages the best of pieces of information and behavior. I mean, as I said, I interact with my bank very often. They know a lot about this. So if we combine these systems, I think it can be very powerful.
Okay. I want to talk, we spoke a couple of weeks ago, you mentioned that you're working on functionality. In fact, I think you may have developed the functionality already to allow payments using tap as well as QR codes, similar to what we see from Zapper and SnapScan, and that you expect this technology will be rolled out in future into smartphone banking apps. Talk me through that, and what does it mean for those independent guys like Zapper and SnapScan?
So, yeah, we've developed this technology and we've partnered with a number of players, and it actually will go live with a number of banks in South Africa pretty soon. And, you know, quite a number of our customers are taking this up. As I've said, we believe it is, if you think about just taking a step back at this stage, the problem with Zapper, SnapScan, and all these are that unlike a credit card where you can take your Visa card and pay at any pay point. You don't have to check, is this a Visa machine?
Yeah.
You currently need a Zapper application on your device if you want to pay at Zapper. You need a SnapScan application on your device. And from a banking perspective, what it does mean is that you have to interface with a different brand. So the next card is not front of wallet. From a customer perspective, of course, it means that you have to trust some third-party application and take a picture of your card and enter it. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of people, specifically newer generations, that do that. Hmm. But there is still quite a lot of inertia around this. And what has been the result is that this, you know, the classic chicken-egg situation where, you know, specifically people don't want to create wide acceptance for these things, although it is changing and changing rapidly. But we think it can be a lot quicker because, firstly, you know, on the one hand, you don't have people downloading applications and, you know, choosing the right one, as I said, whether it's one or the other or, you know, even third parties. And on the other hand, people are not creating this acceptance because people don't have, you know, it's not that prevalent in terms of when you compare it to cards. Although you see these QRs quite wide, if you compare the actual transaction numbers, it's tiny compared to actual card present, you know, type transactions.
Yeah.
So our view is, you know, specifically because we are that widely distributed and in terms of inside banking applications, if we enable this type of payment inside the banking application, it literally is, you'll switch it on. The bank already has your banking, your card details. There's no enrollment required. We can just switch it on and bring X million of customers, you know, pre-enrolled, which, you know, they can't switch this off. It's a feature inside the banking application, mm-hmm. Into the market. And of course, that'll bring the you know, whether it's the chicken or the egg, I'm not sure, but it'll bring one part of that, which in our view will result in the acceptance coming. So what does that mean for SnapScan and Zapper and the likes? You know, where they make their money at this stage is exactly that. It's the acceptance portion. You know, the acceptance, and I think a number of the banks have been missing this in our view, that the QR code is and whichever else replaces that, whether it's you know, an NFC device or a combination of the two, or it's becoming the PAS of the future. Which means actually there's a new retail footprint, or not retail specifically, but I mean POS or acceptance war, if you will, out there. So we don't think that this has that big an impact on them at all. It'll probably just bring you know, more customers their side in terms of that acceptance side. They already have these merchants, and now just more people can actually utilize that. So I think it's quite positive for the entire industry in our view.
With all these developments happening, Skalk, do you think, I mean, we see Samsung talking about launching Samsung Pay in this market. Apple's obviously got its own payment platform. I think Google has something as well. Do you think this market's going to be taken by the banks and local technology companies before these big international giants even arrive on these shores?
I hope so. I think, you know, a lot of these players are planning to come here. But yet again, you know, in other parts of the world, we see that it's not, it has its problems, specifically. You know, in certain markets, Apple Pay and others have got IDNV or identity verification issues where you know, the issuing banks are being held liable, but they don't really know what, you know, who's in charge of this. Their call centers are being inundated. You know, if we can actually create the same type of experience here, create the acceptance and also make sure that you can use that same technology internationally, I think it, there's no reason for the banks not to own the market before these players come in here.
Interesting. Skalk, I did ask you this before, but for the benefit of our listeners, do you see any, you work through partners like the banks, but do you see any opportunities in future to offer your security solutions directly to end users? Are there any aspects of the technology platform that you've developed that could be offered directly?
Yeah. So we have played and looked at this right a couple of years back. I think we deployed our solution as a standalone application, and we made it free, and you could use it for LastPass, but it's not been a focus of ours. The reason for that specifically is the type of organization you have to build is not technology-wise, but in terms of servicing organization, is vastly different. You know, we don't like having large call centers, having to have this. You know, we interface with, as I've mentioned, you know, 30-something groups of companies, which reaches, you know, literally lots of millions of end users. Whereas if you focus on a more of a B2C or even a small B2B with, you know, 50 people here, VPN type solutions and the like, it is a different beast and a lot more expensive. We've seen the likes of other companies in the US where they do this, and you know, it's very lucrative in the US, but also if you look at their cost base, it's multiples of what we have here. Now, I think that plays to what we've seen in South Africa, and I've heard this comment a number of times, to build a B2C business in this country is very quite difficult compared to business to business, just because of the size of the market. You know, our middle class here is 8.9 or 9 million people, and the definition of middle class here is, there's no firm definition that I could find, but it's a couple of thousand rand a month, which is, you know, in most other countries, probably poverty level. Whereas in the States, they've got close to 130 million middle-class people with one of the definitions I've seen of that is $100,000 a year. So, you know, that's one of our top income. So I think the size of the market is just hundreds of times bigger that side compared to here. And if you understand that, building a business here in terms of that and having to scale and compete against these big international players is very difficult. Whereas if you actually focus on the business side, I mean, we've got a super strong financial services in terms of technology player here. You know, we've got a very interesting market in that a lot of the stuff that we, you know, security-wise, but also otherwise, come across, you know, we see here a long time before it's seen in other parts of the market. So we've got certain aspects which are first world, certain aspects which are third world, and that combination obviously means it's easier to actually identify opportunity and problems and take it to market. And I think specifically, especially lately into the fintech, you know, the last couple of years, I think banks are that much more eager to play with, you know, up and coming companies. So I think the opportunity is very big. But to answer your question, you know, succinctly, the technology definitely can be used. We've done this, and, you know, and we actually do this for certain of our customers. And we are looking for partners to actually take this technology layer, because there's no technology, you know, change required. It literally is just, you know, some integrations to you know, some of the software suites that's required. And I think our technology, with the correct partner that looks at that aspect, can be, you know, there's quite a nice business case available at this stage.
Mm-hmm. Now, you do most, if not all, of your dev work in Stellenbosch. Are you able to find the skills that you need locally? Do you hire guys or girls straight out of university? Is there sufficient talent?
Yes and no. It is, it's become a bit easier. I'm not entirely sure why. And it's possibly because we're a bit bigger and, you know, perhaps a bit more well-known for us, specifically over the last couple of years, to find talent. But if you look at the number of tech companies down here from, you know, Amazon, Takealot, a number of the banks have got development shops down here, ACI, et cetera, if you look at their growth, the churn, which is IT churn, is around 20% of, you know, people moving on from company per year. And if you look at the actual number of universities here and the number of engineering students and computer science students that are actually being or qualifying year on year, I think the supply and demand mismatch is quite big. So in terms of total talent pool, I think there's a big delta in terms of what could be taken up.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not battling that much at all, to be honest. You know, we're finding the talent here. And I think specifically a lot of people complain about the traffic in Cape Town. We like it because it means that people don't want to stay in the Winelands. You know, it's just not practical working in Cape Town, or it's very tough. You have to sit a number of hours each day in traffic.
Hmm. First time I've heard anyone actually complimenting Cape Town's traffic, but
we like it.
Do you see, as a matter of interest, do you see any demand from banks for integrating cryptocurrencies into your platform? And if not, do you expect to see that in future?
I think in future, probably. I think, you know, cryptocurrencies at this stage is still probably in its infancy. And crypto technology even wider, you know, let's not talk about currencies only. We've seen that it still has some problems where, you know, people have done POCs, but the transaction in a store takes several minutes, whereas cards takes, you know, several seconds. So it's obviously very promising. And I think in terms of what can be done with this, and what will be done with this ultimately is super interesting. But I think it's still a lot of maturity needs to happen. So we look at all these things. We've not received any demand, to be honest. I mean, you know, yet again, to succinctly answer your question, not a single request.
Okay.
But we do look at this, and we will ensure that we integrate this when it becomes interesting to our customers.
All right. Skalk, before I let you go, let me ask you a broad question. When we met recently, you said that usernames and passwords are dying. What does the future of secure authentication look like, and what is the future of online payment and safety?
So where this is going, I've heard that, as you've mentioned, the username and password is dying, and I think a lot of people think, okay, you know, this technology will be replaced by just another way of, you know, authenticating yourself at a number of places. So the passwords have become so prevalent, and there are so many of them, and we've been told not to use the same one over and over that I think it's very tough to keep track of it. And that's why you have password vaults that can actually try and solve this problem.
Yeah.
But what it actually means is that in terms of username and password, if you think about the cloud being this place where there's a lot of places where you have to, you know, show yourself in terms of digital form. You know, this is my username and password. This is who I am. You're actually represented by a number of just loose credentials.
Mm.
So this is changing quite rapidly. And there's a number of big players globally playing here. You know, I think from Civic, Vinnie Lingham in the US, Only ID that we're playing along with in terms of FIS, Equifax, and even globally, people are realizing that where this is going to is that you actually have a digital persona. Where this digital persona will be, you know, it's being built up by a lot of your experiences, by, you know, how you interact or act digitally, behavioral biometrics, and. And where this is going specifically is that there will be some firm anchor into the real world, and that's where we play very strongly, where we create that link between that digital ID and yourself. And, you know, you can do a lot of things about behavioral. You can see, hang on, you know, Duncan is in Joburg, but his credit card is being used in Cape Town. That can't be, or, you know, different countries type things. So in terms of basic stuff like your GPS and these kind of things, there is a lot of stuff that can be done. But ultimately, there's a lot of instances where people can then, you know, just sit right next door to your house and try and get a payment because, you know, your phone is there. So it boils down to that link where people ultimately will reach out to you and just say, listen, you know, this seems a bit funny. All our rule engines have kicked out that this is not normal. Can you just confirm that this is you? The reason for that is specifically having a user base that you know a hell of a lot about is you can actually build up sufficient data to say that, yes, this person, this is typical behavior. But I think the problem with that is any enrollment, anybody utilizing a service for the first time, is anomalous behavior, which means that enrollment is very painful then. And I think we need to try and bridge that gap. And that's what we say. You still need that gap. Make enrollment easy. Utilize and leverage other enrollment infrastructure and, as you've mentioned, biometrics and even wider. And then create that link. And where this is going specifically is where some other device, mobile now, but, you know, what it will be in the future, we will see. But, you know, some form of very personal device with communications that's locked onto yourself, whereas if the rules break, you know, your fridge wants to order, you know, 100 liters of milk for your neighbor, you can just say, hang on, you know, this is not what I want to do. So, yeah, we live in interesting times.
Great stuff, and you're at the forefront of it, Skalk. This has been a great discussion. Skalk Nortier is CEO of Entersect. Thank you so much for talking to Tech Central today.
Thank you very much, Duncan.